Okay, the Economic Development and Housing Budget Division meeting for Monday, February 9th, 2007.
I'm sorry. Oh, dear.
Boy, we're going backwards. We had 2008 on here before, now we're back in 2007. 2009, we'll come to order. This happens to be my son's 25th birthday today. All right.
Isn't the one that's losing his hair?
Like? He's losing some of his hair, too, yes. In fact, I think faster than I was. All right. Public Facilities Authority, Mr. Coleman. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, it's great to be here. We did provide a packet of information, kind of a little bit of background on all of our programs. I want to go through it briefly. I want to touch on a couple things. A little more depth for discussion, one potential for stimulus funding out of Washington, and then the dedicated sales tax request in the governor's budget, the change order items. And with that, I'll just dig right in. The first page, you'll find an organization chart, Public Facilities Authority. I think most of your members are familiar with it. It really consists of six state agencies.
You know, Mr. Coleman, can you put the microphone a little bit closer, please? Okay.
It consists of six state agencies with the chairman of Employment and Economic Development as the chair and CEO of that organization. The PFA also has an interagency agreement with DEED for my management services of the Community Finance Office, which covers several programs. I believe bioscience is the one that's missing, but we do cover those. And on the next page, you'll see the staffing chart that goes along with that. We not only our employees, but we do pay the administrative costs for the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health to operate the clean water programs and drinking water programs. And they primarily do all the technical items. They rank projects on a priority list statewide. They do the environmental reviews, they do the technical reviews of plans and specs, and then they certify those projects when they're ready to bid over to us, and then we finance them pretty much in priority order as long as they have the means and complete financing package to pay it off. The PFA's mission statement is relatively simple, I think, but straightforward. We use our interagency authority to provide the municipal finance expertise and infrastructure financing programs to enhance the environment and economic vitality of the state of Minnesota. We try to keep our projects affordable and the basic infrastructure necessary for communities to grow and thrive throughout the state in place. As I mentioned, we're governed by six different state agency commissioners, so our mission statement includes six different mission statements, I think. The statutory authority, one of the key things PFA has going for it is our bonding authority. We have $1.5 million worth of revenue bonding authority. We're AAA rated by all three rating agencies in both the Drinking Water Revolving Fund and the Water Pollution Control Revolving Fund. The transportation loan program, those bonds are rated on an individual bond issue based on the makeup of the pool. Those are closed pool revenue bonds based on the participants, where the other ones are open-ended funds based on the total equity within each of those revolving funds. The administrative expense for the PFA is all covered through fees or federal grants. We occasionally try to get some general fund money in the bonding bill when it comes to administering the WIF program, because we get no funding to operate that program. So when we do, try to use that program or funding for that. Get into the next page, where you get into the infrastructure financing programs of the PFA. Start with the biggest one first, and that's the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund. And we provide low-interest loans municipalities for projects. To date, we've done close to $2 billion. By the time the end of the fiscal or the next biennium, we'll be over the $2 billion mark in total loans. So far this year, we've done 17 loans, or last year we did 17 loans, 33 different projects for $148 million. A slight dip from previous years in number-wise, but dollar volume, fairly typical. This year, we plan on doing more.
To that point, if you had the money, how many would be ready to go?
This year, with grant money, potential grant money available through the stimulus package, you'll see a lot of them come out of the woodwork.
No. I would expect about 40. If you had enough money to do them all, how many would be ready to go?
I would say, how many ready to go? 45 to 50 in that range.
And a total of how much construction cost?
$450 to $800 million worth.
Okay.
I'd say over the next 2 years, we could probably do close to $800 million if it was free money and the cities didn't have to worry about how to pay it back.
Jobs?
That tends to slow projects down.
And, estimate of jobs?
I'll give you two answers to that. If you look at an FTE, full-time equivalent, per year as 2,000 hours, you're probably looking at 6.5 jobs per $1 million. Actual number of jobs, you're probably anywhere from 20 to 40 jobs for every $1 million. But, you know, some people will only work a few hours, some people work a couple months, and there'll be some people that work the entire length of the project. Some of these projects will run, the bigger ones, 5 to 7 years construction cycle. Others, you know, you're looking at a construction season with maybe a touch-up the following year. So it varies. But if you're looking at FTEs, you're looking at about 6.5 FTEs, but you're talking about families impacted. You're about 20 families for every $1 million. Does that answer the...
Do the math now. Is that 20,000 jobs or 2,000 jobs?
At $100 million, you're looking at 65 FTEs and about 200 to 300 employees getting a check.
Okay.
But not full, not year round.
All right. Okay. Quorum is present. Okay.
Okay. Anyway, and later I'll show you a graph of the demand versus what we actually do in here, give you a visual picture. We tend to leverage it. I did mention we are a AAA rated revenue bond in this fund. For every dollar of state funds we've received to date, we've done about $13 million worth of projects, so that's pretty good leverage overall. The wastewater infrastructure program, WIF, I think that phrase is used a lot. A lot of times it's also combined with the state match when it comes to bonding. We look for state funds to match the federal dollars to allow us to have the money to provide low-interest loans. But the WIF program is really supplemental assistance to the revolving loan fund. We use that money for two things. One, to match USDA Rural Development Loan Grant. They tend to work with very small communities that have huge grant needs. When they determine a grant amount on a project, the state has provides 65% of that amount, and USDA provides 35% of the grant, plus they make a loan for the balance. So in reality, it turns out the state probably puts in about a third, and rural development puts in roughly two-thirds combination loan grant. And the reason we up the state match or to the used to be 50-50 was to get them to lower their affordability threshold. It started getting very, very expensive in the communities that could least afford it because they were up to 1.7% of median household income and a minimum sewer bill of $45, but we were seeing a lot in the $60 to $65 a month per household just for sewer. And on the water side, that would be the same amount on the water. So you can see the very low-income communities having tremendously high sewer and water bills. They agreed to drop that down to 1.5% if we had provided a little more money. Otherwise, they would be losing their loan dollars to Washington because they couldn't get rid of all the loan dollars. They didn't have enough grant funds to get those to spend all the loan money they got. The other use for the wastewater infrastructure funding program is when we get high-cost projects, when the debt service exceeds 5% of market value in a community, everything over that, we use WIF and spread out the loan from a 20-year loan, because we're up to, under current law, we can do 20-year loans with the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund. Rural Development does 40. We use WIF for that 21 to 40 at 0% interest rate to spread the term out of loans once they hit 1.5% of market value. And we went to market value on that because we were getting a lot of lakeshore properties where the communities tend to be low income, so they qualify for a lot of grant, but the property owners benefiting tended to be lakeshore residents, which had very high income, and seasonal residents, and the market value of the property was significantly higher. East Gull Lake was a prime example where they qualified for about 80% grant funding under the formula when we use median household income, because it's a very low-income community as far as year-round residents go, but the benefit, the lowest income property, was $1 million market value. So we switched to market value, so I wouldn't have to come here and testify to you why we're doing multi-million dollar homes paying for their sewers. But that changed about 5-6 years ago and has been working fairly good. The Clean Water Legacy Programs, and these are the three programs that address that we're seeking the dedicated sales tax under Clean Water for, and I'll describe those three programs and get into our dollar request at the conclusion of my presentation. But the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program, that was, and all three of these programs were created seeing a gap or a need that the two programs don't address, that is the Revolving Loan Fund and the Infrastructure Funding Program don't really target. The small communities, really talking about communities that fall below PCA's permit for discharge, anywhere from 5 homes, although we haven't had anything that small, up to about 30 households. And we're trying to avoid them getting into municipal wastewater by replacing septics. And that program has two components. The first is a technical assistance component. We could provide 100% grant funding to these very small communities to hire a designer to look at replacing the septics. And then they can also contract with U of M Ag Extension for technical assistance to verify the designer's work, as well as help educate homeowners and the community on how to operate and maintain those individual on-site systems. And the second part of that is we actually, for communities where the median household income is below the statewide average, we provide 50% grant, 50% loan to replace those septics, provided the city owns and operates those systems. That is, they get pumped regularly, inspected every 2 to 3 years, and they collect fees either on the property tax rolls as a special assessment or utility fees to maintain that revenue stream to pay for the operation and maintenance of the septics. The total daily maximum load program, this really comes out of when PCA does the impaired waters of the TMDL studies. They've identified the impairment to the water. Then they look at where the pollutant's coming from, and to clean up the body of water, they, in essence, allocate how much pollutants need to be removed in municipality wastewater treatment plants. When their permits are up, those new standards get put in once the implementation study is done. What we look at that program for, because cities kind of screamed unfunded mandates, is those increased standards that they have to address, like if the phosphorus drops down to a 0.03 or ammonia or something like that gets added to their permit, the cost of that additional treatment, we cover half the cost. And those are as-bid costs, so once the project's bid, PCA looks at the bid specs, identifies those components which address that increased treatment cost, and then certify the dollar amount over to us to do that program. And that is directly tied to the TMDL studies and trying to restore impaired waters. The Phosphorus Reduction Grant Program was a started out as a 75% grant program. It changes to 50% grant program in 2011. It was set up to encourage cities to accelerate their treatment of phosphorus, which in most cases is being limited to 1 milligram per liter in the larger communities. The TMDL studies where phosphorus reduction is needed, you're seeing the phosphorus reduction going down to 0.3. So that is a grant strictly to address phosphorus, which tends to be one of the bigger issues. And it was done to avoid the lawsuits, because most permits were being, I shouldn't say most, a lot of permits were being tied up with lawsuits over phosphorus from environmental groups. So it created this program to try to provide grant funding to get the voluntary phosphorus reduction moving and going forward, especially in those where the TMDLs hadn't been done. The next program, the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Program, is newer. It's not quite as, it's not as large as the Clean Water Program. It's only been around for about 10 years versus the 21 years the Clean Water Revolving Loan has been around. Drinking water is a little bit cheaper to actually construct than wastewater in most cases. But we have made over 216 loans, over $426 million, saving taxpayers or ratepayers with reduced interest charges of a little over $86 million. This program is also AAA rated by all three rating agencies. It's also one of the programs. Another program targeted the stimulus package for additional funding. So it looks like a little over 2 years' worth of funding will be made available to this program. I think both House and Senate have $2 billion allocated for drinking water. So to get roughly $35 million additional dollars for that revolving loan program. Transportation Revolving Loan Program, it was initially funded through the federal government. Some additional money was put in twice, once $1 million in the tax bill several years ago to do transit projects, and $15 million in general fund money about 8 years ago. Roughly half of that has already been taken back last biennium or last budget reduction. We're still running loan cycles, doing about 2 to 3 projects every year, coming in there. Credit enhancement program is no direct.
Does the transportation program, does it have something to do with water drainage? Is that why you're involved in it, or what's?
It's just a municipal finance program. Actually, MnDOT came to the authority and asked us if we would apply for the funds, because they applied and got rejected. So we applied to set up a revolving loan fund and actually got the money. We added MnDOT to the board. From our perspective, it's just another municipal finance. Cities need to borrow money. A little more strings attached in the sense that regulated services like drinking water and wastewater, you don't have to worry about referendums or reverse referendums. If you're required to do it, you have to do it. Where this program is a little more tricky. It's not as easy. They are subject to referendum votes or reverse referendum, depending on how they structure the financing. But that's why we're doing it. It's pretty much the same thing, just different state agency we work with.
Okay.
The credit enhancement program is really no state money going into it. What we do is we certify projects that are eligible, and in this case, on the county side, it's for criminal justice facilities, jails, juvenile detention, things like that, where there's actually buildings involved, or social service buildings to deliver social services that the state participates in. When counties sell bonds for those buildings, we'll certify them that if there's ever a default, if the state has money in the general fund and it is an open appropriation from the general fund with no specific dollar amount, we will pay the bondholders and then use the state aid intercept to recoup or negotiate with the county on a payment schedule to repay whatever debt that we had to pay the bondholders. Standard & Poor's has given that a AAA rating and Moody's a AA, so counties can enter the market with a higher bond rating. And I think to date we've certified about $274 million over the last, eight, 9 years. Got a rough savings of interest rate cost of a little over $5 million. On the city side of that, cities can use that program for drinking water, wastewater, or sanitary or stormwater. And to date, we've done 4 projects that just opened up this fiscal year, first time they could do it. And we've done 4 municipal projects for $16 million, saving cities about $300,000 in interest savings just with that increased bond rating that they get when they go to market. So, and those numbers come from their financial advisor when they compare rates in the market that they got with the credit enhancement versus where historically when they sell bonds, what rate they would have gotten in that market condition. So it is a fairly good measure and something that we do not generate and make fiction of. And hopefully there'll never be a bond default, so we never need to use it. Probably won't be any money in the general fund this year to do it anyway. But it does help cities access the market. Also last year when we included cities in that for drinking water, we also created a bond pool, credit enhanced bond pool, for any projects where we can, in coordination with DEED, they've got numerous community assistant projects that provide infrastructure funding, Greater Minnesota Business Infrastructure Program, Bioscience Infrastructure Program, Small Cities Community Development Program. If cities get a grant with that program, we can, and if they need to issue bonds to finance the project, road or sewer extension into an industrial park, we can pool those bonds, sell them on behalf of cities with that credit enhanced backing of the bonds and the loans to the community. That's an added feature. We're getting the paperwork close, ready to go to that. We haven't had any projects move forward with it, but it is another option to expand that tool. Go up behind the first tab, or the says clean water programs, and I'm just going to, since I've already covered them, I'm just going to highlight looking at the demand versus what we do. This is a bar chart by fiscal year, where the demand was. You see it kind of goes up, has gone up steadily, dipped a little bit, and then has gone back up. These are the requests we get in on an annual basis asking for us to fund them. And if you notice, what we funded has been fairly stable the last 3 years. In 2005, there was a glitch and there was no bonding bill, so we didn't have state funds to match federal grants. And we kind of only funded projects that were on the previous intended use plan but hadn't moved ahead. We didn't add any new projects. So we scaled it back, and it took a year to get going again. So that's why that dip in 2005-06. Otherwise, it's been fairly steady. In 2009, the PFA board, looking at the economy, looking at the demand, because we had a record request of, $426 million in projects that wanted to proceed this year. So the board drew the cutoff line. I think the most we've ever done before is a little over $300 million as far as authorizing to proceed. This year we authorized $400 million worth of projects to go ahead. We anticipate a little over half of those moving ahead. I'm expecting, barring the stimulus package, probably in the neighborhood of about $200 to $250 million by the end of the fiscal year. Out of that 400
Senator Metzen has a question.
I should know, maybe I shouldn't know. Who's the board? Is that the...
The board is made up of six
people on the top?
Six commissioners, yes. That is the board.
And who recommends, Mr. Chairman, to them? Do you have a staff? Or
We take the project priority list that the agencies provide us, and every June we send letters out to everybody on the list, the needs list, project priority list, both health and PCA, ask them if they're interested in proceeding over the next year if we make funds available for them to do it. They send back in the request what we call the intended use plan, that is how we intend to use the assets in the fund every given year. We have to give that to EPA. So the cities tell us if they're ready to go, and we go to the board and we look at the capacity the fund has to make loans. If we go over that capacity, how much does that affect our future lending capacity? Because the more we do this year, the less capacity we have in the future to keep making loans, because we subsidize loans. So that eats into the equity every time we subsidize a loan. And we try to do a balance act. We look at a lot of factors, not just who's ready to go, even though this year we had an extraordinary amount of projects ready to go, but also, you know, the economy. A lot of these projects they'd probably do on their own. Developers would be chipping in on a lot of growth projects, paying for some of that cost, so we get a lot of construction. This year the developers and the growth just aren't happening, so what you're seeing is pressure on public funds to finance these projects. So the board drew the cutoff line at 45 points and authorized $400 million worth of projects to proceed, but that was not always an easy decision, not always an easy staff recommendation to balance that. But it is a balancing act every year, and not an exact science. Things can happen, and we can have a real bad year.
So how many projects are you going to be able to fund under clean water this year?
We're hoping to get about 30 done. I think we've already done about 13 loans. Some of the projects will, some communities will have multiple projects that they could phase, and sometimes we'll do more than one project. Met Council is a prime example. They might have 6 to 18 different contracts going. And if those individual projects rank high enough, we'll put them on the list.
Are the 261 mentioned here, you only get down to 30? Is that what I'm hearing? Or am I on the wrong? We're on the green sheet. So.
Yeah, on the green sheet, all the shaded ones are ones we've already issued the contracts for this year.
Okay.
And you'll see the various programs, not only the PFA programs, but other funders that we work with, and we've gotten almost all the funding agencies to agree to use the project priority list, even though they've got different criteria. But they do use the list to establish their priorities. When you look at the clean water, where it says base programs, clean water loan, 2009 IUP fundable range, when you see dollar amounts in that column, those are the ones that requested funding from us. If it's a blank there, they might have a high-ranked project, but they're not ready to go this year. They may be delaying it, waiting for other assistance or whatever. But if it's or they've gotten funds from other sources, like the very third one there, Watson, you don't see any money under the Clean Water Revolving Fund. But that's because we're using WIF to match rural development, and rural development is going to make a loan grant to that community. But we do include everything, and we include all the list, all the other funding agencies. So when the funding agency commits to a project, we put the dollar amounts in there, and we just put reserve as far as the grant amounts, because we don't actually make an award until the project is bid. But we've set aside the money that's been appropriated to address.
And what's more important, the PPL rank or the PPL points?
The points determine the ranking. If it happens to be tied, that's fine. Like you see, three projects all have 90 points, so
And so how far down the list are you going to be able to get, what rank are you going to be able to get to?
We drew the cutoff at 45 points.
Okay.
Goes all the way back to the third page. Where we cut off the funding, the last one that said they were going to go was Bertha. That's correct. And we have been looking at projects that are shelf ready, readiness to go, that aren't ranked high enough, and if the stimulus package does come, depending on what funding level, dropping that cutoff point down. It all depends how much money we get from the federal government, but we're looking somewhere in the 38, 35 point range. Several projects are ready to go if they could get low interest loan money. Starbucks, 37 points. Lakes, 36 points. Projects, they're ready to go if someone will finance them, but they don't want to go to the market and sell bonds. Is that kind of an answer? No? Must have answered this question. And that's kind of the list. And if anybody wants to talk individual projects, I'll gladly meet with them later.
Yeah, we don't need to do that here. How does the governor's budget affect your agency?
The governor's budget provides money for the Clean Water Legacy programs. And if you go to the last tab, Legislative Initiatives, you get in to the governor's request. There's $2.8 million.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
can we also work from the budget pages? I gave this lecture in one of my other divisions, but it's really getting tiresome. I just mentioned this to Mr. O'Rourke, where we get these kinds of things, but we get the budget pages from the governor, and we work from the budget pages.
Right behind it is the budget pages.
We got the budget books here, so.
Yeah, the budget books is here. I also included our section right behind my one-page summary of the budget documents, if that's what you're looking for. It'd be behind the last tab.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Glenn, I see it, but somewhere, you know, if we work from the budget books for the purposes of our, Mr. Chairman, unless you're going to have a million pieces of paper in front of you, at least in the old days, every agency worked from the budget books, and it sure made things a lot easier. But, Mr. Chairman, maybe you're smarter than I am, and you can work from a million different pages.
I might be smarter than you, but working from the budget books is probably a good idea.
And just for your reference, in case you don't have your budget book, I included it in my handout behind the last tab.
I understand.
Well, let's go to that page, because that's exactly what I want to know right now. And my last question is how the governor's budget is affecting your agency. So,
yep. And
I appreciate the overall view, but we do need to find that out.
First page, my memo just really lists the governor's three requests, three programs, kind of summarizing the budget pages. And it is $2,875,000. That includes the technical assistance component as well as the loan grant to actually do the replacement of the septic systems. And we have worked with all the agencies that are working on clean water issues. We looked at what we all wanted to accomplish. We put together a budget. The Clean Water Council did the same thing over the past year. They put together a budget separate from us. The G16, which lobbied heavily for the Clean Water Legacy Act and the constitutional amendment, also had requests for funding. Line them up, they're all proportional, give or take a percentage or two. So it's pretty close. And the only change in the governor's recommendation versus Clean Water Council is the governor's looking at only funding the Clean Water Legacy programs at one half level the first year to allow the state to collect the sales tax. The full sales tax is not going to be there the first year of the biennium. And given the economy, I don't give them some leeway as far as that. So he looked at the agency's request, assuming a full year of funding, which is the agencies put together initially, and reduce that in half. So this request will reflect that half funding in the first year and then full funding the second year. The total daily maximum load grant is the second one. That's 50% grants for those components necessary as far as a TMDL implementation plan that gets put in on permittees of municipalities and the phosphorus reduction. And that program, we're looking at $5 million the first year, $10 million the second year of the biennium for that. There's further discussion in the budget pages on that. And then the phosphorus reduction program, we're looking at $5 million the second year, but half of that the first year at $2.5 million.
Take me back to what you said about the Clean Water Fund and the governor not funding it the first year.
Funding at half level was the recommendation, with some caveat that there are some staff. You know, the PCAs have staff that are working on the prepared water studies, the implementation plans. Those are staff that were funded last year with one-time money. So there will be some exceptions. But as far as giving this money out in the form of grants to implement, it's all we do. Looking at not starting that until January. Kind of a half year's worth of funding first year.
And you'll be trying to qualify for the constitutional amendment money also? Is that what I kind of heard you say there?
All three of those programs were created with the dedicated funding in mind. There were all three in the Clean Water Legacy Act, which Senator Fredrickson carried. I know there isn't a neat tie between the constitutional dedicated funding, where the money goes in the clean water account, but the intent of the Clean Water Legacy Act was that there would be dedicated funding for those programs.
And in the event that you do qualify, how much do you think you will qualify for?
The governor's request is what I'm requesting out of the sales tax. All three of those change order items we're asking come out of the clean water account.
So you'd end up with the same amount as this last biennium? I was hoping you'd have more.
I think municipalities would like to see some more. I shouldn't say unfortunately. I think what we need to do is realize that the impaired water studies, the TMDLs, have just started. And this is enough money to address the municipal share of the implementation plans that have been approved. Only 20 have been approved. There's 120 in the process. So next biennium, you're going to see the eligibility for TMDL grants probably quadruple this, and then we'll be looking at how do we modify the program to be able to still provide some subsidies so cities aren't screaming unfunded mandates.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. The first question I have is when you're putting together your point system, if I recall from talking about this with one of my communities, one of the things you look at is the cost to the homeowner for, you know, what they're paying for sewer and water. What I wonder is that part of that formula take into consideration the income of the average income in that area? So do you just look at the cost and compare it statewide, or do you look at the cost in comparison to what the income would be to give you an affordability number? So that's my first question. And then my second question is, since the constitutional amendment said that the money that was supposed to pay for new kinds of programming, how do you justify funding something that was previously not paid through that funding under that, with that kind of as coming from the amendment funding?
Yes. Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, all dynamite questions. I wish I had perfect answers. The ranking is not affected by the cost of the project. The ranking is strictly based on environmental criteria. The type of subsidy, we look at the cost per household. That is, the more expensive system and the lower the income, the more subsidy we try to put in a project to keep it affordable. The wastewater infrastructure funding program is a prime example, but the revolving loan fund, the interest rate, we provide 1.5% discount for all cities. So all cities get a break. But the smaller communities that have higher cost per median household income, population factor, sewer rates is portion to the median household income of the community. We offer additional discounts down to a 1% loan. But actually, they can get 4.5% off. If the market was 8%, we can knock 4.5% down. But we do have a minimum of 1% loan.
Okay.
So that's where we look into it. And some of the real high cost ones, we also, if you look on the green sheet, you'll find a lot of other grant programs like USDA Rural Development, Small Cities Block Grant. Funnel their grants, target their grants into the real high cost projects when it they do work. The relatively small dollar amounts, like the small cities, up to $3 million a year. USDA Rural Development probably gets anywhere from $6 to $8 million a year in grant money. But it doesn't go very far when you're looking at dollar wastewater systems.
Chairman.
Did he get the other?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that was helpful.
The second part of the question was.
and
the point I'm trying to get to is our base program is the revolving loan fund, wastewater infrastructure program. Those have been around for a long time. These three programs were created to receive dedicated funding. So yes, they were on the books before the sales tax amendment passed, but the intent was that. You know, these were three areas where there was a gap where existing programs don't cover. There was some one-time money appropriated. There was some money appropriated twice for these programs in the bonding bill. So that's all I can tell you on that. If you're looking at the type of where this money will go, it will not go towards your normal municipal wastewater infrastructure project. Those will use the loan and the WIF. When you have an impaired water, the cities have an increased permit standards that they've got to treat more than their standard existing permit because an impairment has been identified. There's phosphorus or ammonia or turbidity or whatever. To get those increased discharge standards, that's when we're looking at the total daily maximum grant. And PSA will certify that dollar amount based on the as-bid cost of those components over to us, and we'll provide half the cost, 50% grant, up to $3 million. So that's how I justify it. It's not we're not trying to create all kinds of programs. We really created these three because we saw gaps in what we do. The small community program is just something we've never done. And when we try to finance them with municipal wastewater systems, they tend to fail and be obscenely expensive on a per-household basis. We can find out we can replace septics anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000, $12,000 for a real good one. If you try to municipal sewer these projects, we're finding costs in the $30,000 to $60,000 range per household. So the small community wastewater treatment program is really trying to get cities off municipal wastewater and try to look at low-tech, low-cost solutions, but an area we've never addressed before.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Chairman, let me try to understand Senator Olson's question and your answer again about the legacy funds or that new money coming in. Is this going to backfill what the administration took out? Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Coleman.
To make it whole like it was intended to? Maybe I didn't get your answer right, or maybe I...
Oh,
seems to me your budget was cut in this critical area, and we're going to make it whole by the new constitutional amendment that the people voted for thinking, I think they voted for it, thinking it's fresh money, it's new money, it's on top of these things. Is it? I make myself clear?
There has been no cut to the PFA in the governor's budget. We only receive $100,000 in general fund money, and 100% of that goes for technical assistance grants to small communities to hire a designer to see if septics can be replaced on the individual lot, and for the University of Minnesota Ag Extension to help city owners educate them so they know how to operate and maintain those systems if we replace them. That is still in the governor's budget at general fund. So there, we haven't, these programs have been funded in the past with under the bonding bill, but it was part of that clean water legacy bill that was passed before the constitutional amendment, the session before, all designed to receive dedicated funding. So that's all I can say. The governor hasn't cut this budget because we don't have any general fund money to cut, except for that $100,000.
Well, I think that's a good explanation. I just wish that you had all the clean water money plus the legacy money, because I think that this is a place where we need to do a real lot of work, and there's a real lot of communities that need to get the job done. I think you guys are doing what you can based on the money you got, but I would love to see more. That's what my whole point is.
Mr. Chairman, maybe.
Where would the amount of the, here's my question to follow up, Senator Metzen, where the amount of money that maybe isn't being backfilled from the governor but is getting us up to the same level as last year, where's the difference going?
For the PFA, we've been pretty much held harmless.
Graduation party.
The budget cuts.
Graduation from what?
It will probably reflect next session in the bonding bill and what the capacity is to issue bonds when we go in. Historically, the state match to the federal cap grant, we've been getting one-to-one match the last two bienniums. We hope to continue that, even though the federal government requires only a one-to-five match. But the need is so great. You've given us more money to allow us to do more projects. The wastewater infrastructure funding program could be another one because of the budget pressures that may reflect in the bonding bill next year. We've been getting an average of about $15 million every other year for that program. In some years, $20 and even $30 million to subsidize those projects, keep them affordable. That may be in jeopardy, depending on how much we can bond next year. But as far as the general fund budget, we pretty much don't operate on general fund. Everything we do is operated on fees charged to do these financing. And the same goes with the staff at PCA and when it's related to clean water programs and drinking water programs, the staff needed to do the reviews of the projects we're financing and not all, they still charge permits to do the permits, but we do cover those costs, and we're not reducing our funding of them at all.
Any further questions of Mr. Coleman? Any further comments?
You did mention about more money, and I just wanted to make a comment about the stimulus package. The House has passed their bill. The Senate supposedly is going to pass theirs to the in-conference committee this week. There is going to be a sizable amount of influx of new capital if that indeed becomes law. The House bill is looking at roughly $100 million. The Senate level, on waste, strictly on the wastewater side, the Senate's looking a little over $60 million. That will be a tremendous benefit. The thing that I may need help with in the House bill requires half that money to be used in grants, but it has to come out of the revolving loan fund. So I'll have $50 million available via additional subsidization to get projects moving, supposedly. I may need some statutory authority to do that because right now the revolving loan fund only allows us to make loans. So I just want to let people know, and EPA wants the stuff out fairly quickly. So once the final bill is done, the Senate doesn't have the specific language of 50%, but they authorize additional subsidy. So I would be more than willing to seek input, a rational approach to do, but we will be looking at similar formulas of the WIF program and the drinking water programs called disadvantaged community. EPA actually allowed us to use, we use 10% of the EPA grant to provide what they call principal forgiveness or a grant to those real high cost projects in small communities. So probably want to expand that. We don't have time to do rules because that just takes too long if we have to get this money out in 180 days. Just something that will be further discussion on budget-related matters, but we won't be asking for more money because there's no match required. But Senator, we will be asking for legislation.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coleman, so are the requirements from both in both the House and the Senate bill the same in terms of?
Slightly different. In the House requires us to use half the money, 50%, in the form of grants, and then 20% of that grant money for green. They don't use the word green infrastructure, but water conservation, energy conservation related to municipal wastewater, cogeneration, those kind of things when it comes to wastewater be in the form of grant. So a different twist. The Senate allows it but doesn't mandate a specific dollar amount, so there's some similarities but yet differences. I think the House spent a lot more time and has multiple pages where the Senate is like a page appropriation. It'll take some work.
Although in any event, we'll probably know by Saturday.
We're hoping. And I'm hoping next week I've got a board meeting scheduled. Get their authorization, legislation, and then start that process. Right now we don't have a bill drafted because aren't quite sure. But it is something I would like to move quickly if indeed it comes about.
Okay.
But I want it to be logical and rational.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and obviously this relates not just simply to Mr. Coleman, but if we assume the President signs this on Monday, which I think is the date that he's now talked about, I think he wants to sign President's Day. If we assume we have that legislation in place by the weekend, by Monday, I assume the governor will factor the monies into his – well, the monies will be factored into the – forecast on March 3rd. Obviously, I don't know what the governor intends to do in terms of the supplemental budget subsequent to that. But at least for our purposes, we should have a pretty good idea of what's available for usage. And certainly, whether it be your agency or any other agency, hopefully can have language back to the divisions, to the chairman within a couple of weeks or so, way ahead of our budget calendar.
I've not tracked the entire stimulus bill. I've only concentrated on the clean water side in both bodies.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't expecting you would take care of the entirety of the bill for the administration, but in terms of your piece and then obviously every other agency's piece and the
There will be some coordination, obviously, on the entire package to the governor's office.
But even if there's – if you anticipate – if you're suggesting some concern in terms of – what might be required either by way of maintenance of effort or how you handle the process. If we have that next week and if agencies in working with whether it be the Attorney General or whomever have a pretty good sense of that, that should be way ahead of our budget process in terms of any finality to what we're doing. And hopefully you'll have a good sense of that and can then direct if it's rider language in bill form, whatever, back to this division.
And we'll try to do our our side, at least put something on the table, debate and discussion quickly.
Now, is the federal money dedicated to certain funds that you have, or can you use it anywhere you want?
There'll be so much dedicated to the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund, so much dedicated to drinking water.
Okay.
So roughly between 160 on the clean water, depending on which side, and about 35 to 40 on the drinking water. And the dollar amount's same, both House and Senate, on the drinking water side.
Okay. Any further questions? not, thank you. We'll be in touch. We're gonna jump to the Barber and Cosmetology Board here for our next presentation. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gina Stosfast, and I'm the Executive Secretary with the Board of Barber and Cosmetologist Examiners. I'm here today to discuss the governor's recommendations, but I will start off with a short overview of the board. The board was created in 2004 by legislation that merged the Board of Barbers with the Cosmetology Division of the Department of Commerce that creates a standalone board that's housed within the state's other health licensing boards in conjunction with an administrative unit that provides support to all health licensing boards. There's currently 7 members sitting on the board, and that's 3 barbers, 3 cosmetologists, and 1 public member. The board regulates over 38,000 licensees and has 28 different types of licenses and registrations. This includes like 1,500 barbershops, 2,500 barbers, 4,500 cosmetology salon licenses, and over 30,000 personal individual licenses. Each year, we approximately increase our licenses by 10%, and 4% of licensees do not renew. The board's budget. The board receives a direct appropriation from the state's general fund to cover the cost to operate the board. The board's revenue is currently $1.55 million, and out of that, $252,000 is generated from barber revenue, and $1.3 million is generated from cosmetology. Currently, the board has only appropriated 48% of our revenues. This includes a base budget in fiscal year 2008 of $829,000 and fiscal year 2009, $729,000. In regards to our license fees, the board is on par with other states in regards to the licensing fees. However, if our fees were reduced to match our appropriation, Minnesota would be the 7th lowest fee cost in the nation. The board staff is myself, an executive secretary, 5.3 full-time in-house staff, and 3 full-time inspectors. The governor's recommendation, as you can see on page 6 and 7 of your handout in your binders, is a $90,000 increase to our base budget for fee collection and cost recovery. What this means is this fee collection and cost recovery is actually not increasing fees of any currently established fees. Rather, it is to assess late penalties, specifically in cosmetology, for those who do not renew licenses in a timely manner. And the reason I say in cosmetology is because in barbering, there already is a late penalty associated. Further, the fees, as you'll see on page 7, are duplicate license fees, letters of verification, name changes, and a processing fee. The anticipated revenue that we would collect is $90,000. If we do over-collect, it does stay in the state's general fund. As well with the increase in the fees, MNSPA, which is the professional association in Minnesota that cosmetology licensees and barber licensees can belong to, they also support this legislation for a late fee. With the $90,000 base budget increase, it is still leaving our agency in fiscal year 10 with $162,000 shortfall, and in fiscal year 11, $189,000 shortfall. In baseline operations, this would include salary increases, rent increases, increased cost of business, and as well as increased cost to other state agencies. A little bit about what our board has done in the past few years. The first thing I want to touch on is an electronic advancement. When I joined the board in 2006, the barber licensing was done on recipe note cards and was housed in 3 separate systems. And cosmetology had an outdated and inadequate licensing system that did not provide for payment management or general reporting queries. Throughout 2007, and it went live in May of 2008, the board moved to a web-based e-licensing system that 4 other health licensing boards use in the building I share with them. Some of the features that are included are online renewals. Other things that are included, which is not a part of your blue binder, but I did provide it to you in the supplemental material today, is all of our inspections that are done on all of our establishments are now done on tablet PCs, and the individuals at the establishments get these printed out right on the spot, versus you can see a comparison on the following page. It's the one that's landscaped. These were used to be carbon copied, and virtually no one could read them because they were triplicate copies. So all licensing is done now on tablet PCs. We have a complaint management database with our e-licensing system. We have continuing education, a board meeting management system, a violations history on each licensee's profile, and all transactions from the initial application to payment to license to disciplinary matter is all housed in one location, and thus paper files are being eliminated to scan files. The board's website has been fully developed in the past few years with all applications, license verification, questions, answers, events, newsletter, board meeting agendas, and board minutes are all available on the web. The board publishes a newsletter as well, which was included in your packet. Some of the accolades the board has received in the past 2 years is we did take, it might be small to you, but to a small agency, it is an honor. We took third place in the National State Boards of Cosmetology Convention for our newsletter. A current board member sits as the president for the National Association of Barber Boards of America. And the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul will be hosting the 2010 National Association Barber Boards of America National Conference. Some of the collaborative and cooperative practices we use in our agency is that we utilize and share the following services with over 17 other health-related boards. This includes budget and financial oversight, human resources, purchasing, and technology. Thus, this eliminates us from having to hire our own staff to fulfill these functions. I did mention earlier that the board has only appropriated 48% of its current revenues, and I'm not asking for a decrease in by any means at all in our fees. However, if we are ever able to have that entire funding appropriated to our board, there's a couple items that we would like to pursue, which is rule changes. When the board was housed in the Department of Commerce, the Cosmetology Division, rules have not been updated for many years. The board does need a major rule revision on all rules, and this takes some funding to do that. Staffing, the board would it is more than needed to hire a full-time investigator, two additional receptionists, a licensing analyst, and an office assistant. And when I ask for the two additional receptionists, if you look at the bottom of your provided packet, we receive on average 8,000 phone calls a month, with our highest being 17,000 and our lowest being 5,000, which averages out to about 50 calls per hour. We receive an average of 3,500 voicemails a year, and currently we only have 1.5 people to answer the phones. The last item in regards to our lack of appropriation is continuing education. Currently, the majority of our licensees do not have a continuing education component as a part of renewal, and we would be more than happy to have this type of system in place. However, in order to monitor 28,000 licensees in continuing education and to actually enforce it, we would need additional funding. That is my short presentation, and I would be happy to answer any questions for you.
What are they calling about?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
These 8,000 calls, what are they calling about?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we get calls because it is a very transient population in cosmetology. We get a very enormous amount of reciprocity phone calls. I'm moving from North Dakota. I'm moving from Iowa. I went to school in South Dakota. What do I need to do? We do have everything on the web, but people are calling. They're calling for their license status. Those are now online. We receive just an enormous amount of phone calls in relation to comparing myself to the other boards in the building. Our walk-in traffic is tenfold. People want to come in. They want to see us, and that's how we deal with them.
Does somebody say something here?
No.
Are there complaints included in these calls?
Well, the complaints, if they have, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, if we're getting complaints, it's not, we have a formal complaint that they fill out on the web, so a majority of these calls are not complaints. They are just inquiring about their license, that, you know, they've submitted their license. It's not necessarily complaining about, you know, I'm not getting this or I'm not getting that. It's how do I do this? How do I submit my application? I'm going to be a manager. I'm currently an operator. What do I need to do?
So these calls aren't from people that are calling in and complaining about some service they got. They're about barbers and cosmetologists calling in and trying to find out information.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's trying to find out what they need to do to either get their next license or...
Are there any rules about being able to charge Senator Sparks the same as they charge me for a haircut? No, you don't have to answer that one. One last question. And this $90,000 that your governor seems to think you can raise, is that what you calculated as being late already? You already know that hasn't been paid. Is it just a guess, or what is the $90,000 exactly?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, with our systems that we have and database systems that we now have in place, we're able to calculate how many people have not renewed prior to December 31st or their scheduled renewal date. So these were all done based on adequate calculations as well as like how many requests we received for a letter of verification. Like the letters of verification are basically we verify their license to another state because they have to go directly from state to state. The state boards don't allow the licensee to have contact with that information, so it's not fraudulent. This was based off we kept a running ledger of how many verifications requests we get. Could it be reduced because we'll start charging? It might be reduced because at moments we will get someone calling our office saying, well, I think I might move to Florida, Arizona, California, Texas, you know, or South Carolina because it's 20 below and they're thinking of moving. And so we have to submit letters of verification to all five of those states where there is a possibility if the fee is assessed, they might think a little bit more closely of which state they really want to move to. But this is not an uncommon practice in other state agencies.
Senator Cook.
Mr. Chair, so I'm just going to make sure, but right now you are not able to charge a late fee if they don't renew on time. You're just processing them late and there's no additional. Okay, so that's what this would.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and this is only in cosmetology, we're not eligible to charge a late fee. The cosmetologists renew their licenses every 3 years. There is no late charge. The only time they would get a penalty, and it's not a financial penalty, it's an examination penalty, if you will, is not for 3 additional years. So you're looking at a 6-year time period that there really is no assessment of any sort of penalty, if you want to call it an educational penalty or a financial penalty. So that is correct.
And I think Senator Dibble would like to know if the 52% that you don't get goes to the general fund of the fees that you charge. You only get 48%. Would you like to ask that question for Senator Dibble?
Yes, as
since I know this is your area.
My hair is not nearly as nice as
No. I mean the 52%. You said the board currently is appropriated only 48% of the revenue that it collects. The 52% then goes to the general fund for other purposes. Is that what?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, so all of our money is deposited in the state's general fund. So currently right now about $1.5 million. And our current appropriation for fiscal year 09 is $749,000. That is our current appropriation. So approximately when someone renews their license, depending on the fee, if you're looking at someone who's an operator, they pay a $60 renewal fee. Roughly $32 of that stays in the state's general fund and is not appropriated back for their fees to their licensing agency. That is correct.
Which
sure. Another little profit center here, I see. Yes. Making money. Sounds like a whole lot more licensed cosmetologists.
Sounds like the Commerce Department a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does sound like Commerce.
It's the government model, after all.
Are there any questions of the witness? Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. And we'll probably be in touch if we have bills coming through that are concerned with this.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. McElroy, are you around still?
what I was having published.
Okay. You and I pay about the same for a haircut, you know.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I certainly identified with that question of the Board of Barbers. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. With me is Mark Loftus, the Director of Business and Community Development and Master Projector Runner. We provided a few PowerPoint slides, and they're all referenced to the budget book. So we will. I'm going to make some general introductory comments, and then each of the division directors will work with you through their portion of the budget.
Senator Cohen's not here right now, but if he comes back in, you better have a budget book in front of you.
I've got one right here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I'm all set. And I think each of the division directors will use the budget book as closely as is helpful.
Okay.
But we started our budget process by looking at the mission, what it is that we are asked to accomplish. Some of you are new to this process. DEED is a relatively new agency. It was formed 5 years ago from the merger of the former Department of Trade and Economic Development and the former Department of Economic Security. We have a little longer statutory mission, but the mission we work with every day is that we exist.
How has that worked, that merger? Did we save any money on that, or
saved some money, but the big issue is that we've integrated services in workforce development and economic development because they're such closely related issues. And when we work both with existing employers or new employers, it's been really, we think, very helpful to have the two functions together. It hasn't been without some time to make the change, but in hindsight, other states appear to think we did it the right way. When we go to national meetings, the Minnesota model is considered a good example.
Are there any other mergers being proposed here that you know of?
Not that I know of at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I would state that when the merger took place, there was a fair amount of some disruption. It is not without some challenge to merge two longstanding agencies, but now that we have done it and we're about 5 years into it, it was clearly a good thing to do in this time of high unemployment and a challenging environment for attracting new businesses. I'm glad that merger is behind us. But the mission statement is one I'm very proud of. We exist to support the economic prosperity of individuals, businesses, and communities by improving opportunities for growth. In everything we do, we try to refer to that mission statement. We have six agency goals, assisting in creating and retaining jobs. Virtually everything we do is done with partners. In the creating and retaining jobs, we're working with local economic developers, the initiative foundations, regional development corporations, individual companies, and others. We also work to cultivate entrepreneurs, principally through our 9 small business development centers, but in a variety of other partnerships. We work to enhance community vitality, both through programs like Contaminated Sites Cleanup Program and the Small Cities Development Program and the Redevelopment Fund, and in the effort that we do to help keep businesses in communities that help keep those communities vital. We have many workforce-related programs you'll hear about in a few minutes, but strengthening the workforce and the connection between workers and jobs is a key part of our mission. We also foster self-sufficiency. We have a number of special programs for those who have barriers to work, such as vocational rehabilitation, state services for the blind, and jobs programs for disabled veterans. And then we assist in addressing economic change for individuals, businesses, and communities with a variety of programs, including the Dislocated Workers Program for individuals, our alliances with industry, coalitions like the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota and the Renewable Fuels Roundtable, and a variety of other programs. We do that, Mr. Chairman, turning to the next slide, with about $740 million of resources. And we do not, for this slide, include unemployment benefits in that because it is paid from a trust fund. Is separate from our administrative funds. That $740 million is about $506 million of federal funds. The Petroleum Tank Release Cleanup Fund, sometimes called the Petro Fund, $12.4 million. In the 10-11 budget proposal, $77.6 million of general fund dollars. $96.6 million from the Workforce Development Fund, and special revenue funds of $40.8 million. We could get into some detail on each of those as we present the divisional budgets, Mr. Chairman. Where that money goes is on the next slide. Unemployment Insurance Administration, which is all federal dollars from the federal unemployment tax account, about $95.7 million, or 13% of our budget. Business and community development programs, which include the Petro Fund and contaminated sites cleanup and related programs, at $102 million, or 14%. Workforce development, including Voc Rehab, State Services for the Blind, and Veterans Programs, $503 million. And then all the administrative costs of the agency. And this rounds up to 5%. It's actually 4.6%. We work very hard to manage and control the general administrative costs. That includes human resources, information technology, space, all of the costs of administering an agency with about 1,600 employees. The change items, Mr. Chairman, we'll go through briefly here, and they're also included in the divisional presentations.
Commissioner, are the agency-wide budget, are those basically people, those costs? Are those people costs, or are they?
The general support services, Mr. Chairman, are a mixture of salaries, rent. We are in virtually all rented space. We have two of the 47 workforce centers are owned by the state, and a call center in St. Cloud is owned by the state, but the balance are rent. Utilities, risk management costs, information technology costs, significant costs that go to the Office of Enterprise Technology to run the mainframe computers that support unemployment insurance. There are significant costs in addition to employees, but there's certainly a number of employees. The agency has a total of 1,600 employees. I don't have off the top of my head how many are general funded, but the majority are in direct programs.
Okay.
The change items, Mr. Chairman, some of these are shown here for your information, but they will show up in the tax committee budget because they are tax credits. The first item, the angel and early stage capital, is two tax credit proposals intended to create investment in early stage companies for the purpose of creating jobs in Minnesota. It has a total cost over 12-13 of $25 million. Part of that to an early stage angel credit, and part to a program for insurance companies to provide a credit against their gross premiums tax to create an investment pool for investment in slightly larger but also early stage and spread across the state. The base budget reduction is in two parts, $8.98 million from the general fund and $3.3 million from the Workforce Development Fund. And we will go through that again as we get further into the budget. There is a general fund proposal of $100,000 each year, $200,000 total, for assistance to the BioBusiness Alliance to continue with implementation of their 2025 roadmap. Green jobs, this is a bill, the idea came from Senator Anderson. She introduced this bill in the last session, and the governor was quite impressed with it, so we have joined her in proposing that. It has a cost in the first biennium of $3.65 million and in the second biennium of $6.6 million. Those, Mr. Chairman, will show up in the governor's budget before the tax committee. The Section 125 grant reduction is a reduction from the Health Care Access Fund. In the very closing days of the 2008 session, there was a provision in the Health and Human Services bill that appropriated $1 million from the Health Care Access Fund. And set it to us to administer a program for small business to help pay the administrative setup charge for what are called Section 125 healthcare plans. They're essentially cafeteria-type plans. The availability of that money is to be later this year. We have not issued any grants from the program as yet, although we're prepared to do so. Governor's proposing to reduce that to proposal from $1 million to $200,000, so that shows up here as a negative $800,000 from the Healthcare Access Fund. We're also proposing, Mr. Chairman, an appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund, $3 million each year, to provide additional services to job seekers in the work in our workforce centers. The the job seekers services have been provided by federal funds from the Federal Wagner-Kaiser Act, which has been level funded for 25 years. And so the number of staff that we have had available to assist workers in workforce centers has been declining. We have increased demand for a variety of services. Bonnie Elsie will be back before you in a few minutes with the details of the Workforce Development Division budget and can go into that proposal in some detail. It's no secret that the workforce centers are very busy places this year and for about the last year because of increased unemployment, and so we're anxious to have some resources to provide additional assistance. The next slide, Mr. Chairman, shows where DEED employees are located. We have
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I guess I'm curious what a universal job seeker is. I mean, constantly looking, or what's the...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, that's an excellent question. They are people who are not eligible for one of our programs. They may not qualify as a disabled veteran. They may not qualify as a dislocated worker under the program. So they are our general public customer, and our terminology for them is the universal customer.
Okay.
So they are essentially your constituents and our citizens who aren't eligible for any of our categorical programs.
Thank you.
Commissioner, as long as Senator Kubley brought that up, if you're going to move $6 million from the Workforce Development Fund to the Universal Job Seeker Fund, how are you going to replace the money, or what are you going to use?
Mr. Chairman, and we'd be happy to provide, and I think probably have with us, an accounting of the fund. The fund has had a surplus most years, and we've also recommended fewer direct appropriations from that fund for other programs in order to make resources available. Projection for the fund is that the fund will be in balance. You may recall that because it had a significant balance, more than $15 million, we lost $8 million from that fund last year to the general fund as a budget balancing tool. We had about $6.5 million as a balance up until the January meeting at the Job Skills Partnership Board, and we moved $5 million into the Dislocated Workers Program to provide additional assistance in workforce centers. There are sufficient resources in the Workforce Development Fund to make that appropriation of $3 million, Mr. Chairman.
If it shows that it's going to be depleted, and it could be by the end of 2011, you have the ability to raise the fee from 0.1 to 0.12 in order to make sure you have funding in there. You'd be willing to do that, wouldn't you, in order to create jobs?
Mr. Chairman, we would be hesitant to do that because of the comparison of our total cost with the states around us. And we will be happy to discuss that with you and with the governor. The 0.1 is as high as it has been. None of the states around us have comparable fees to that, and our unemployment costs are already fairly high. But yes, that is a possibility. We're also hoping that there'll be some funds for the Wagner-Peiser Act and for the Workforce Investment Act and the federal stimulus package. That would provide some additional assistance also, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Chairman, the next slide is simply a map of where DEED team members are located. Approximately 1,600 team members, about 800 of them in St. Paul, and the balance in 47 workforce centers and vocational rehab offices all over the state. The map indicates kind of where those are located. Those are in programs like Job Seeker Services, Vocational Rehabilitation, State Services for the Blind, Veteran Services, and a few of our economic development programs. With that, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to take you through our three operating divisions. Mark Loftus, who's Director of Business and Community Development, will take his programs first. Then I'll speak up again and explain a few slides on the unemployment insurance program. Lee Nelson is here or will be here shortly to assist if you have detailed questions on unemployment insurance. And then Bonnie Elsie will cover the Workforce Development Division. She's Director of those programs.
And Mr. Loftus, if you can take us through these areas and focus on jobs, job cuts, agency budgets, differences in agency budgets from this biennium to the next biennium, governor's recommendations, et cetera, and if there's any kind of federal effect on the possible stimulus package, right, what they might be.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Loftus. I'm the director of the Business and Community Development Division. This pie chart is not in your budget book, but it does show you that the general sources of assistance from that provide assistance for our division. We are the smallest operating division within the department. We have 61 positions, and in the budget cuts that the governor has proposed, we would lose 5.5 positions in total. Those are open positions today. They are not layoffs of current positions, so that's I may come back to that as we come to specific offices as well, because we are relatively small. 53 of our 61 current positions are funded by general fund. And federal funds represent many pass-throughs, grants and loans that we provide to other jurisdictions. Petroleum tank release is the primary source of our contamination cleanup program. And special revenue represents revolving funds and fee accounts, and I'll come back to some of those as well. The first of our five operating offices within the division is the Business Development Office. Primarily funded by the general fund, there are 9 positions in this office that are either regionally assigned, and they live in the area that they serve, working with companies, or they are assigned to specific industries like renewable energy, biosciences, and also serving the manufacturing sector. In the past year, this office, and we have a lot of engagements with companies directly. Sometimes those are half-hour conversations, have a visit with a company. In other cases, they are more sustained interactions, where it might be several days or even months of effort to work with a company to help encourage them to expand in the state. In the past year, in 2008 calendar year, this office worked with 37 companies that are expanding in the state. Many of those are inside the state, but some of them are companies that are located elsewhere. And in those projects, you see the number $660 million of investment and 1,800 new jobs that are potential within those projects. A good example of a company outside the state, actually outside the country, that made a decision to expand here is a company based in that will be in Red Wing, the name of Hydro Controls, an Italian-based manufacturer of electronic controls for agricultural farm equipment. They are building a new facility in Red Wing, you know, an Italian company. We need that kind of foreign direct investment. But another example of an in-state company that's making an expansion is 3M, which is expanding, has an $85 million expansion in Alexandria. And as you follow the history of companies like 3M and other corporations, they've done a lot of offshore expansion in the past and job creation. And we're proud of that project because it represents an in-state expansion that we're able to capture here. And we're also working continually with new projects that are considering the state. One way that we try to promote the consideration of the state for expansion is marketing of the state. And this office in the past year was involved in 28 events both in the state and outside Minnesota. For example, in May, coming up this spring, we will be at the Bioscience International Trade Show and also the Wind Energy Trade Show in Chicago. And it's a way for us to market the state. And when you see the revenue accounts here, a special revenue fee, that's principally fees that we garner from other organizations, cities, utilities, construction companies that want to help us market the state. We receive those funds in a special revenue account, and then we use that to help pay the cost of those events. So those are very helpful because we don't have a general fund appropriation for the most part for marketing. So we rely on partners. The next office is the Entrepreneurship and Small Business Development Office. This is page 23 to 25 of the budget book. There are two primary components of this Office of Entrepreneurship. First is the Office of the Small Business Development Center program. We have a state appropriation to provide grants to the small business development centers in the state, $560,000. And as you see on the page, these centers, there are 9 affiliates in this partnership with us. that have matching funds from their region, and also we provide federal dollars to them. So it's a three-part partnership between the state and federal and local. In the past year, they worked with something in the range of 2,500 businesses, and they attribute 6,000 jobs created and retained to the services that they got from the Small Business Development Centers. And as you see, there are also metrics of investment that they were able to capture by seeking assistance from banks and other sources, as well as tax revenues that were generated by their services. So we're proud of the fact that the $560,000 a year has a very, very profound impact on the ability to provide free counseling to businesses across the state here in the metro here, where there's one center and there are eight centers outside the Twin Cities. This office also contains the Office of Science and Technology. And as many of you have met her, Betsy Luffs is our one-person shop, basically, working with companies who are trying to access federal dollars to bring a new technology into the marketplace. And we have a $100,000 appropriation in the base. That's been in there for a couple of years. We had one-time money this year from last year's appropriation, $400,000. The governor's budget does not propose to continue that into the next biennium, but those funds, by law, were written to be able to carry forward. So if we don't spend all of that, we can spend that in 10 and 11. But Betsy and her office is using those funds to help provide small grants to companies to help them do clinical trials, to help bring a technology. There was one we signed off on today to help bring a technology out of the university so they could conduct the tests that it takes to bring that into the market. So we are using that $400,000 principally to help some specific projects like that bring a technology out of the university and to further develop their commercialization process. That office works with these companies to get the federal dollars, and the number $27 million is not all attributable to Betsy's work, but she's worked with a good share of the companies that have gotten those monies in the past year, bringing it into Minnesota. And as many of you have heard in the past, we have, as a state, have not gotten as good a share as we should based on our population in federal dollars. So this is every dollar we get in federal monies is certainly a bonus for the state's economy. The next off.
So, Mr. Loftus, is that 400 being eliminated in the governor's proposal?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it's not. It was a one-time appropriation that's not continued in the governor's budget.
So he doesn't think it's working?
It's working very, very well, Mr. Chairman, but given the priorities and the inability for us to increase the general fund budget in our program, in our department, we didn't have the resources to do that.
Seems to me you might want to rethink it if it's creating jobs or creating new products or whatever it's doing. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. The next office is Job Z and Business Finance. This office has, in the last year and a half, become the home of Job Z, which had a different home in the department before this. And you certainly have all followed the history of Job Z. We had major work by the legislature last session and critique of the program by the legislative auditor. In the last month since the session ended, we've been undergoing major work to revise the program. The legislature put in some new controls and some new reporting that's been very helpful. And also the department itself has changed the way we administer the program. Now all projects have to come to us for approval. We examine the return on investment for the project. We ensure that there are no competitors that are injured by the proposed Job Z project. And we evaluate each one and have a standard agreement that makes it clear what their expectations are. So when I have the metric there of 6,392 new jobs, we feel very confident in that number. That's based on our intense review of the forms that we got based on their performance through the end of 2007. 315 projects, and I can give you more numbers on the ones that are out of compliance if you like, but we have a good understanding of where we are today with that program. Minnesota Investment Fund is a program in this office as well. It has currently.
This last one.
Yeah.
There's always the interesting word retention. So how many of the I guess let's go to 2007. How much of those 3,128 jobs were jobs that were retained as opposed to new creation?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the number in the I believe it's 500 that are new and 2,500 that are part of, counted as retention.
So were the 2,600 previous jobs tax-paying jobs and now they're not tax-paying jobs? Is that what's going on right now? Would that be a good way to put it?
Mr. Chairman, the retained jobs are within companies that all of them did add jobs, but they also had existing employees who are part of those projects that got jobsy benefits. So the jobs themselves still pay taxes as individual taxpayers. The company itself, though, based on the project that they conducted, would be exempt from jobsy taxes.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. But a company that expands in Minnesota, take Acme Widget as an example. If they had $10 million in property prior to a JobZ transaction and then expanded and added $5 million of tax base, it's only the new tax base that becomes or the new expansion that is exempt from property taxes, for example, or the sales tax on construction material, not their historic investment.
Why do we put the retention of jobs in these statistics then? Because they have a tendency to skew what's actually happening when you look at the retention part.
Mr. Chairman, we keep them separate so we can have that discussion, but there are times when we're concerned that if we didn't get the expansion, we wouldn't keep the company.
We do that at the IRRRB also, and I'm skeptical that that's a necessary statistic. But anyway, I'll let you go on. Senator Parasol, did you have a question?
No, I think it weighs into the final result. I think it's a legitimate thing to keep track of.
Well, if they were going to go somewhere, maybe, but if they were going to stay anyway, it might not be. But anyway, go ahead, Mr. Loftus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Minnesota Investment Fund is also part of this office, and as you know, this is a revolving fund now. Last year, the projects that we worked with, the cost, there were 586 jobs in the projects that were created. And that was at a cost of $8,600 a job, which is roughly the metric we've been in over the last 5 to 10 years, between $5,000 and $10,000 a job. It's a program where we make a grant to a city, and they in turn use those funds to make a loan to a business. So roughly $8,600 last year in the program. And in our budget also, you see the Special Revenue Fund. That's where the Minnesota Investment Fund is, the 21st Century Minerals Fund, the Indian Business Loan Program, the Urban Initiative Program, all have current balances in those programs. The community finance area is a collection of the programs. Mr. Coleman alluded to some of these earlier. Some of them have been around a long time, like the Small Cities Development Program. Last year provided 40 grants to 86 cities for $17.5 million. That program, along with the contamination cleanup program, have been in our department for some time, and as you see, have substantial leverage over the last 5 years, $220 million in expenditures in all of our programs in this office, with about $2 billion, just a little bit over $2 billion in total project costs. So it's a 10-to-1 leverage in those programs. Some of the programs in this section of our division are funded currently by bond dollars. We don't have general fund appropriations, so that includes redevelopment fund, Greater Minnesota Infrastructure, and bioscience public infrastructure. And as always, these funds are oversubscribed. And in terms of federal dollars, Mr. Chairman, you asked the question about this is maybe one area where we could have some federal money coming in. It's conceivable that the Small Cities Development Program could be in line for some of that stimulus money. And currently we have a total of about $20 million that we would anticipate this year, and that might go up several million. It's hard to know until that
from process. From the feds?
Yeah.
Are we required to match it?
We are not. Well, that's a good question, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if that – currently we do have – we provide a state match for the administration. We don't provide a match for the direct grants. So I think if they follow the rules, it would not be a match.
And is the money intended for what we've been hearing all along, jobs that are shovel-ready? or what are we, what is this different? What I just.
Mr. Chairman, if it is put into the current Community Development Block Grant Small Cities program, then a variety of city-proposed projects would be eligible. And if we get to set criteria, having them ready to go quickly will be one of the criteria that we will set. We have not seen language in either the House or the Senate in detail yet on this program.
Okay.
The last part of our division is the Minnesota Trade Office, and we have been working very hard in the last several years to help companies export, because research systematically shows that companies who export tend to be more profitable. They have a better strategic sense of direction, a broader base of customers, so they tend overall to be more profitable. So our staff work with them to conduct training sessions, counsel them on a one-to-one basis, answer specific questions about exporting to a particular country, and also, of course, conduct the trade missions with the governor, sometimes with the governor as to Israel, sometimes not, as to a trip to France last year. And in total, the trade office worked with 1,778 clients last year. And as you see the number, we have had record high exports in recent years. Most of these exports, about two-thirds, are from manufacturing, but we also export agricultural products and services, legal and accounting, those kinds of services as well can be exported. So Canada, of course, is our number one trading partner, and China is second, and you would earn bonus points in a trivia contest if you knew that Ireland was our third largest trading partner.
Ooh.
So in terms of exports. So that's largely because of the medical device sector. Companies like Medtronic and St. Jude ship their products to Ireland, and then they process them, work on them, and ship them around the world from there. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the sum of the – and the trade office is almost entirely funded by general fund dollars. The revolving fund here is the repository of the fees that they charge for training conferences, as well as the trade mission costs that they receive from participating companies.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Thank you. Mr. Loftus, maybe you can help me a little bit. I'm looking at the general funds appropriation sheet that we have with us. And I'm just curious. I see that – I understand that we need to share the pain and we're in some tough economic times. But if you look at, like a program, the Center for Rural Policy and Development, which I think has done a lot of good things, saw a base reduction, actually zeroed out. Entrepreneurs and Small Business Grants zeroed out. Minnesota Investors Congress zeroed out. And while the Metro Economic Development Association saw about a third of a reduction, it wasn't zeroed out. I'm just wondering what the thinking behind that might be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sparks, sure. If I could take that. If these were not easy decisions, as we have made clear, these are all good organizations. We tended to ask the question, to what extent are they directly related to the mission and our goals? And while rural policy research is an enviable undertaking, it's important. We weren't able to connect it to job creation or workforce development, at least directly. Now, this is the governor's recommendation. We understand that that's the one part of a longer discussion. I have a great deal of respect for their new director, Brad Binstad, and for their previous directors. We ran out of money before we ran out of priorities, Mr. Senator. In terms of the Inventors Congress, again, in fact, they've made a lot of progress. I used to think of that as an event. It is an evolve toward being both an event and a program. But if we were not able to identify direct job creation from it, the Entrepreneurship Center in three southern Minnesota counties, they work in Blue Earth, Faribault, and Martin counties. They're a fine program. We provide some of the same services through the Southern Minnesota Small Business Development Center in Mankato and also one at Marshall. And it was a tough decision, but one where we ran out of dollars before we ran out of priorities. In terms of groups like MITA, they have a track record of both starting companies and adding jobs. Women venture the same way, and that's why they continue to be in our recommendation for pass-through funding. Of the $8.98 million in reductions, $6.8 million are coming from direct deed programs, about $2.326 million in reductions to our kind of general operations, and $4.486 million to the Job Skills Partnership, which is an internal program that we lament having to reduce. And then the balance, about $2 million from pass-through grants in the general fund.
Thank you.
Chairman, the next item would be to go to the unemployment insurance program, which is on page 35 of the budget books. I'm going to deal, very honestly, principally with the administrative costs. We can answer any questions you may have about benefits or other issues. But the unemployment insurance program is a program that is both a creature of federal law and state law. It was created in the Wagner-Peiser Act of 1936. Is funded, the administrative cost is funded by a grant from the Federal Department of Labor through the Federal Unemployment Tax Account, or FUTA. It has stayed relatively stable in recent years at about $47 million a year. That funds about 400 full-time equivalent positions, pays for our customer service center, for employer compliance audits, for some reemployment assistance in our workforce centers, and for the technology to operate that system. The $1.2 million in special revenue is from penalties and interest on employer accounts. That's a much larger amount, but the balance of it goes into the general fund. My recollection is that something like $4.8 million of biennium. By law, $1.2 million goes into the unemployment insurance program and the balance to the general fund. The kind of statistics on the program are shown on slide 15. In 2008, 214,000 Minnesotans were paid benefits of just over $1 billion. And that's for the calendar year. We anticipate that will be a higher number in 2009, in the range of $1.3 to $1.4 billion in 2009 because of increased levels of unemployment. 130,000 employers filed wage reports on 2.7 million employees each quarter. Employers paid almost $800 million in taxes on those employees. We held 22,000 appeal hearings, audited 3,000 employers, and conduct, in addition to the regular unemployment program, 9 special programs, including shared work that some of you may be familiar with, Trade Adjustment Act programs, and a variety of extensions. We currently have a federally funded extension called Emergency Unemployment, and also a state supplement to that program for those who may not qualify for because of a technicality slipped through a loophole. I want to thank those of you who were involved. That bill was passed very quickly, signed by the governor, and went into effect last Sunday. 1,400 applicants have already filed for benefits under that state extension in the first 4 days of its existence.
You have 214,000 Minnesotans in 08. How many were paid in 07, do you know?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I may be able to find out. Lee, do you know how many were paid in 07? Mr. Chairman, from memory, Mr. Nelson tells me about 186,000 in 07.
Is that a...
I don't think so. He has a notoriously good memory, but Mr. Chairman, we'll verify the number and get back to you. But it was certainly, we paid more in 08 than 07. We'll pay more than 09 in 09 than we did in 08. An issue that I know that you are concerned about and that has gotten some national attention is the state of the trust fund in Minnesota. We currently, as of January 1st, 2009, had approximately $500 million in the trust fund. There's no question that we will need to borrow from the federal government at some point. And depending on how close our unemployment rate is to the national rate, that will come either in late 2009 or early 2010. That is automatically provided for under federal law. There is a fairly significant amount of money in the federal unemployment insurance trust fund at the moment. If that's insufficient, the trust fund automatically borrows from the U.S. Treasury. So I want to make clear that it is likely we will go into deficit, as we did in 2001 and 2, as we did in the each time we've had a recession, we've gone into deficit and borrowed from the federal government, borrowed very significantly in the 80s and paid them back. So it is a concern. There are interest costs involved. We are not going to make a recommendation at this time because we don't know how deeply we'll go into debt or when we will go in, but it's likely we'll have to look at how we pay those back, whether we pay them back through a state surcharge or through a reduction in the federal credit. Our workers should be very clear that there will be sufficient money to pay any benefits owed because of both our trust fund balance and the ability to borrow from the federal trust fund, Mr. Chairman. If there aren't any questions on that, I'd like to invite Bonnie Elsie to come up. Bonnie's director of the Workforce Services Division, and she'll take you through the balance of the budget pages that deal with our workforce programs.
Welcome, Bonnie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Elsie for the record, and I am the director of the Workforce Development Division. My division has about $500 million. We are the largest division in the department. We have, in my division, about 900 and some employees. The majority of the money, as you can see on the chart, comes from the federal government, 68%, in various different programs. And the next largest comes from the state's Workforce Development Fund, and then the general fund. Most of the general fund money is to draw down federal funds. Most of the general fund money we'll see as we go through the budget pages is in match for vocational rehab and state services for the blind. We also have some special revenue money. Most of that is in state services for the blind. There's a little bit in job skills partnership program and also in the displaced homeworkers program. Okay, well, let's talk about business services. In the business services, and if you want to follow around along in your budget books, it's on page 40 to 42. All the slides have on the top where you will find the budget breakdowns in your budget books. The general fund, we get about $9 million under business services, and most of that money is in the Job Skills Partnership program. As you will see in the sheets, that is an area that's taking a substantial cut. It is not something that we wanted to do. There is a little bit of relief in one occasion because we have been very successful in this past 2 years receiving what we call from the Department of Labor community based job training grants. We have received $10 million that have gone to different community colleges in the Minsky system to provide and develop curriculum for new occupations, so that is going to be helpful, but it's still going to be painful to have to cut the job skills partnership. But I just want you to know that we have received $10 million in community-based job training grants. And we also received a $5 million award in Wired, which is a grant that we received in order to really transform an agriculture area of our state into a more alternative energy and bioscience region. And so there's money for training in that grant also to work with businesses. We receive about, in business services, about $9 million from the federal government. Most of that is in the Wagner-Peiser program, as well as a federal alien labor certification program that we do, and we also administer the WOTC tax credit program. And
excuse me, Bonnie, let's decode the acronym.
Okay.
WOTC stands for Work Opportunity
tax credit.
It's a program that provides a credit of up to about $2,400 to employers who employ those who have been long-term unemployed or on welfare for a long time or have been in prison. And it's one that we are continuing to try and make aggressive use of.
Good.
And the business services make up the majority of what the federal money is spent on. We have 35 staff that have contacted over 4,300 businesses. What a business service staff do with business is they really serve as a kind of an HR department for small to medium-sized business. They help them write position descriptions. They take job orders. They work on retention issues. There's a number of things that they do to try to help small business be successful. They also make a lot of referrals if they need additional assistance. Another thing that it pays for is our Minnesota Job Bank. It's called MinnesotaWorks.net. And it is our online matching system that we renewed this. Actually, it's about a year and a half ago we put up a new job bank. The Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program trained more than 13,000 workers and leveraged nearly $24 million in private investments in 2007.
You know, Commissioner, when you have results like that in some of these programs, and you're eliminating things like Boys and Girls Club or Youth Build, why wouldn't we try to figure out a way to combine these programs so that we can continue to do them? Do you need statutory authority for us to give money across program lines, or can you do it yourself? It seems to me when we have something like Boys and Girls Clubs that have a really good track record of creating jobs for these kids, that we shouldn't be zeroing them out. Is there a way to figure out how to borrow from Peter to pay Paul, or to at least include them some way in the budget so we can continue to do them?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it wasn't an easy decision. They certainly do provide after-school and other enrichment programs in 22 locations across the state. The governor has been heavily involved in assisting them in raising private sector dollars, where most of their dollars come from. It isn't likely that there's a way to combine them. Many of our programs for workforce services have fairly significant federal rules in the Workforce Investment Act and in the Wagner-Peiser Act. I didn't have in my bag of tricks a way to get to continue to get them $2 million without reducing the amount of money that we spend, for example, in this Locate a Worker program or in our Workforce Center proposal. But we will... We understand it's a good program, as I said, which is not unusual, even in the best of times, to run out of dollars before we run out of priorities, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chair, really the different funding streams have their own eligibility criteria for each funding stream, and so it's appropriated by those funding streams, and those are appropriations and guidelines that you have set.
Yes, and that's where I was wondering if we change legislation some way, if that would work and we could keep these things going, given the dollars that we have. I mean, do we need legislation to be able to cross-subsidize some of these things? Or?
Mr. Chairman, we may have to do some research. I think it would take federal legislation, for example, to use Workforce Investment Act. I would note that we did not recommend a reduction in Minnesota Youth Program. That's currently a $7 million appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund. We get about $10 million in federal youth as part of WIA, but we did not have sufficient dollars to recommend funding for Boys Clubs and Girls Clubs.
Senator Pearsall.
I was just going to say it depended on the source of those dollars and what they designated them for, if it didn't come out of our general fund or our
like Workforce Development
Treasury.
Fund, for example, could be a spot where you could tap into for moving money around, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, the challenge with that is that the Workforce Development Fund is used to fund the Dislocated Workers Program, and there's been a substantial demand in that program. And so the more special appropriations that we do out of that fund, the less dollars there are to serve dislocated workers. We had carried at some times a significant balance in that. We've now used the balance to provide greater services in our workforce centers. We show kind of a technical balance of about $1 million. I'm hesitant to go below that because the amount of revenue isn't an exact science. It's an estimate. And so we have the Workforce Development Fund fully committed, Mr. Chairman.
Or the Universal Job Seekers Program. That's what you've committed it to, though, right?
I can explain that. We're going to get into adult services now. So the general fund, we're recommending $1.1 million. And what that funds is Twin City Rise, Northern Connection, and LifeTrack Resources. Twin Cities Rise customers are mainly men of color. Northern Connections is in 12 counties in west central Minnesota, and it's basically a resource center where people can call and get directed to the important and valuable resources within the community. And LifeTrack Resources works a lot with our refugee programs. The majority of the money in our adult services comes from the federal government, and it comes through We Adult, We a Dislocated Worker, Wagner Pizer, and senior services for people that are 55 and older. The Workforce Development Fund is the majority is the Dislocated Worker Program. And I do want to explain that we have asked for an appropriation of $3 million a year out of the Workforce Development Fund to serve what we call the universal customer. But really what we're talking about here is serving unemployment insurance claimants. Although they can also work with people that aren't on an unemployment, the emphasis here is to get unemployment insurance claimants services as quick as possible. I have done a substantial study of the Dislocated Worker Program and found out that people who are laid off from mass layoffs, where we get a WARN notice, are enrolled in a Dislocated Worker Program 3 days before they file a claim for unemployment insurance. But people who are laid off from small companies, which is the majority of our layoffs, it's not the layoffs you read about in the paper, but it is the majority of the people that are permanently separated on unemployment insurance, those people are enrolled and get services in a Dislocated Worker Program 15.6 weeks after they file a claim for unemployment. So if they want training and they want to seek out training, half of their claim could be over before they even have an opportunity to know about the program. What we are recommending with this $6 million is to the state staff, job service staff, and the unemployment insurance program at the federal level are both paid with FUTA tax. And there's no data practices between UI and Wagner Pizer. So what we are trying to do is find a more rapid way to get unemployment insurance claimants identified and sorted and brought into the workforce centers and let them know about the services. We have three different kinds of sorts that we're looking at. First of all, we would like to be able to look at how many of the claimants, according to demographics, are on unemployment insurance right now who do not have a high school education. We would really like to connect them to adult basic education while they're unemployed. At the same time, we want to be able to look at how many of the unemployment insurance claimants are structurally unemployed versus cyclically unemployed. If they're structurally unemployed, what we're really talking about, their skills need to be updated if they're going to be competitive in the workforce. Those particular people we want to get in dislocated worker programs right away. And if they're cyclically unemployed, we want to be able to provide workshops to them on how do you write a resume, how do you look for work, how do you interview for a job, where can we give you some job leads.
There's got to be something to the fact that the workers that were notified that they were going to be laid off had information about the programs, whereas
exactly.
The workers that weren't in the program for 15 weeks, they weren't notified, and they didn't have information about the dislocated
That's
workers
right.
program. So, is it a good idea for us to make employers provide information to employees when they lay them off about it? Is that?
That
doesn't sound like a difficult thing. But
first of all, they have received. It's not that they've never received information about the dislocated worker program. They just haven't paid any attention to it because unemployment insurance does mail out something about the dislocated worker program, but they also get a lot of other paperwork about unemployment insurance, and so they're probably not reading it, and they're still just trying to come to grips with the fact that they are unemployed. Through the unemployment insurance system, we can call those people in to the workforce centers and give them an orientation on all the services in the workforce centers and work with our partners at the local level to come in and to talk to them about the dislocated worker program. We want to get people as fast as possible to the right resources. And One of the ways that we can do that is to invite them in and let them know what services are available. If they are not interested in coming back, obviously they don't have to, but we do want them to know that we hear too often that I wish I would have known about this program earlier. And we want to make sure that they know about what options there are, whether it's training, adult basic ed, or just job leads.
So we don't call them in right now?
No, we have not been calling them in.
Mr. Chairman, there's also, and both Ms. Elsie and I have been visiting workforce centers, an increased demand for our workshops, the creative job search, resume writing, interview skills, job search networking, and an increased request for assistance in how to apply for unemployment insurance or how to use a computer. Searching for a job is dramatically different than it was as little as 5 years ago, where you may have looked at a paper want ad, sent in a paper resume, gone to an office and filled out an application. Searching for a job has moved into the online world fairly dramatically, and there are many job seekers that simply need more help.
Are we going to start calling these people in?
Yes, that's what we want to do, is start calling these people in. And right now, to be honest, it's a capacity issue. We have to have staff in order to not only call them in, but to do orientations and to work with them on job-seeking skills and resume writing. So that's what this proposal is about, for the additional $3 million a year for the $6 million for the biennium. There's special revenue also in the adult services, and that special revenue is really the displaced homemakers program. The special revenue now is a marriage tax and a divorce dissolution charge. So that goes into a special revenue fund to pay for the...
Why is the marriage a tax and the divorce is a dissolution charge?
The gentle version. That's the gentle version.
I believe the technical terminology is that it's a surcharge on marriage licenses and on divorce filings. But Senator Cohen, unfortunately, has stepped out of the room. These were both part of a bill that he shepherded through the process about 5 years ago. And... the theory being that displaced homemakers are displaced in part because of divorce, and so he funded it. There is a couple of dollars on marriage licenses, and I think it's $6 on the filing of a divorce.
Back to the $6 million. How many people do you expect to hire with the $6
million? It will be $3 million a year of 40 people.
40 people. So 40 total or 80 total?
No, 40 total each year.
So it would be 80 total.
No. The $3 million pays for about 40 staff for first year of the biennium, and the same 40 staff the All second right. year of the biennium.
All right. It's going for 80. What the hell? Okay.
What were you going to do with that figure after you got it?
We're going to have 80 people hired. That's a good thing if we're hiring people, you know.
What?
That's good if we're hiring people. Go ahead.
I'm going to move to youth programs. The majority, again, of our money for youth programs comes from the federal government. We get $15 million for the biennium from the WIA program. And then from the Workforce Development Fund, there's $12 million. The $12 million includes the Minneapolis Summer Youth Program, the Minnesota Summer Youth Program, the St. Paul Summer Youth Program, the Minneapolis Earn to Learn Program, and also Youth Build. The majority of these programs are to provide summer jobs. The Youth Program, the Youth Build Program also does a lot of construction and environmental refurbishing in that particular program. And the Minneapolis Earn to Learn program is mostly serving people of color. The program provides about $3.65 return for every state dollar that's invested. We serve about 10,000 youth in these programs.
Why would we cut it if we got that good a return?
We aren't proposing to cut this except for, I think, was it Youth Build?
Well, we're cutting Minneapolis Learn to Earn. We're cutting Boys and Girls. We're cutting St. Paul.
Well, first of all, it was a small cut. I do want to tell you the economic stimulus bill is proposing right now Minnesota would get about $14.5 million for a summer youth program. So that's more than all of these put together, if that passes. But it's both in the Senate and the House bill.
So if we had all the money, we would have $28 million times 3 as a return, right?
If we had what?
If we had all the state money and the federal money, we'd have about $29 million, and we'd have a threefold return on that money.
And the Mr. Chair, the federal money is a year-round program, where the Workforce Development Fund, those are more summer programs. And what's proposed in the stimulus package is the majority of it is to be spent on summer programs.
Okay.
Jobs for youth.
Senator Dibble, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a suggestion, if that does actually happen. You're probably already thinking about this, because there's also a lot of resources that will come probably through Commerce, Department of Energy or Office of Energy Security for efficiency retrofits for buildings, residential, et cetera. It's a great opportunity there to pair up maybe through the trade unions and these kids as apprentices, maybe through the Youth Build Program, some of that work that's going to be carried out this summer.
Good suggestion. Thank you, sir.
Next.
Let's go to vocational rehabilitation. This is a large program which receives a federal appropriation in the biennium of about $92 million, but it does require a dollar match for every $3.7 that we draw down from the federal government. So the vocational rehabilitation program, of course, is working with people who have severe barriers to employment, and the purpose of the program is to remove those barriers so they become gainfully employed. The vocational rehab program does require the match, and we have recommended cutting the general revenue money that goes into the vocational rehab program, but we feel that we will be able to match the vocational rehab program and its maintenance of effort by borrowing forward, because they're on a federal fiscal year, and this is a state biennium, but we would probably be asking for additional dollars so that we would meet that match requirement again in the budget year 2011. Any questions on that?
No, I don't think. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would that put us in a worse situation in the tails? And if we're looking, you know, in the future, is that going to be kind of digging us a deeper financial hole?
We have done that in the past, where we've had to borrow forward. And basically what we're doing is we're taking with the state fiscal year, we're taking that first quarter to pay back the federal fiscal year and have not match a quarter in that federal. Like if our federal fiscal year starts, let's say October, it's always October 1, and we didn't match the money in the third quarter, we would take more of the match in the new state biennium. We'd take the first and second quarter so that we would make sure that we would match it for the entire year with the federal program. Eventually, we'll catch up to you, yes. But this is one of the areas that we felt we could cut right now and not hurt. Hopefully, our financial situation will be better in 2 years. This is what we're looking to do for this biennium.
So is this like, are you going to pay for this with the tobacco money and bonds for it, or what, what's?
Mr. Chair, if you would, if you'll let me, yes.
Mr. Chair, no. That would simply be that we would have a $442,000 additional need in 2011, relatively small in the context of the overall budget, but it's an opportunity to let the federal government finance their own match for a quarter. We did it last, I think, in 2001 or two.
Okay, then just to answer Senator Olson's question, does it add to the tails or no?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it does.
Yes,
by $442,000.
Okay, all right. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This sheet that's the white sheet and has down at the bottom, the Workforce Development Fund categories, I'm kind of struck by the fact that there's a, and I guess at the top of the page this says it's in thousands, so those are millions down there then?
Yeah.
That's okay. Correct. It's 32,000 thousands, so it's 32.
So you've got Minnesota Youth Program at 7 million.
That's correct.
Minneapolis, 2,600 or 2,000, whichever column is appropriate. Youth Build for their own figure, Alliance of Girls and Boys Clubs, and St. Paul. So the rest of the state gets the 7.
No,
am I understanding that correctly? Because the others are designated for specific programs or organizations.
That 7 million is divided amongst all of the
including the ones that are designated here?
That's correct.
Then why are there two figures? Why do they have a designated figure here and they're part of the 7 as well?
Mr. Chairman,
I mean, if the whole state has to split up the 7.
Well, the two central cities of the first class have made the case over the years that they have larger populations of at-risk youth and have a need for these programs. They do report results in terms of the percentage of their participants that gain employment, what the wage levels are, and what the long-term results are. It would not be inappropriate to ask them to come and present those results. We do monitor them.
They have done that.
But it's in addition to these state dollars, there's also 7-point-something million of federal Youth Workforce Investment Act that's distributed. We make an investment in youth, but it's a good investment. But the simple answer to your question is the legislature has been convinced, and the governor doesn't disagree, that those two central cities have a higher number of at-risk youth.
I know they do. I lived in one. I was born and raised in one.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, you know, the other rationale is that, you know, if you've lumped in, you know, the ones that are specifically designated for St. Paul and Minneapolis by whatever formula.
And Youth Build and the Boys and Girls Clubs
right.
are designated.
But by whatever formula. You know, the need that's that can be well demonstrated in Minneapolis and St. Paul just isn't met. And I'll go further. A few years ago when these resources, about $3 million, were line item vetoed, we saw a direct result in a spike in crime that summer. So it is, and then when it was restored, we immediately saw a drop in crime. So, you know, it's, you know, I invite you to come to those neighborhoods in particular where this...
But there are rural areas, and when the rest of the state gets to split up 7, well, maybe no, all of the state gets to split up 7.
But still, if everything was lumped in together, though, like I'm saying, the need that's well demonstrated in Minneapolis just isn't met. And, you know, if you want to come to the north side and spend some time with me and go to these Youth Build sites and that.
The east side,
I mean,
of St. Paul is getting pretty bad. I know what it's like over there.
Well, and St. Paul has resources, too.
Yeah,
so,
I know.
So, you know, just kind of leaping on that designation without really thinking about its effect. You know, we've got to think about the policy outcome.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we were to just... You know, I guess just to weigh on this conversation a little bit, I would have to say the hard thing when you see something like that being a rural legislator is that the need is so great in so many places. I have no doubt that there are significant needs in the metro area that aren't being met. But then there are those needs spread around the rest of the state, too, that just aren't as concentrated in one area because, of course, the populations are smaller. But if you look at them on a per capita basis, you probably would see many pockets around the state with the same kinds of problems dealing with crime, dealing with poverty, dealing with, you know, I have a high concentration of those kinds of issues in some parts of my district too. So that's why there's this sort of, we don't want to be in competition with each other because we know that there's a need everywhere, but it's hard to see things that just go toward the metro.
What we can do here is we can I'm sure there'll be bills, so we can have this discussion when we get bills. But guys are making good points, and I think the best point to make is that these programs are very effective, and cutting them is counterproductive. And so,
I think we should have a hearing because I think Senator Olson hit the nail on the head when she said concentration.
Mm-hmm.
It goes on in the Jordan neighborhood, the Hawthorne neighborhood, those neighborhoods of North and near North. I seriously invite you to come tour those neighborhoods to understand the qualitative difference that the concentration, the intensity of those kinds of social problems has, and why the designated amounts of money are needed. It's very intense, it's very concentrated, and it needs, concentrated intervention every single summer. There simply are not any of the kind of community supports at all. And literally, crime spiked when that was cut out a couple of years ago, because there was just nothing for kids to do, so the gangs just swooped right in. Crime spiked beyond all points of reason. As soon as we restored that money and restored the ability for those community organizations to reach out and engage those kids, crime dropped, and the crime levels were unbelievable. So, I mean, we can have this conversation. I'm happy to have it because I think it's easily defended.
I'm just trying to get you to stop having it right now so we can get through the budget.
Well, I'll have it
some
more.
Sorry I asked the question.
No, it's okay. That was a good question. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to talk about state services for the blind. It is a part of the same federal Vocational Rehab Act in Minnesota. The blind agency is a special agency. It has obviously disabilities that need to be handled in a different way than the general people with disabilities. There's a lot of adjustment to blindness that is done in this particular program. And so State Services for the Blind receives $11,972,000. Some of that is to draw down the federal match, but also a lot of that is to serve seniors. Blindness does increase with age, especially in the senior population with macular degeneration, and we have a very good seniors program here. Some of the general fund money is also used to pay for the communication center. We just celebrated, actually, an anniversary for the radio talking book, and maybe a lot of you have heard about that. But it was the first radio reading service in the world, actually. And State Service for the Blind in Minnesota was the one that got it started. In the Services for the Blind, we also have a special revenue fund. And what that really is there's a revolving fund in our business enterprise program. And our business enterprise program is a program where blind people have their own business, and revenues come in, and they need to pay expenses, and they get salaries, and they really have their own business. But that's part of a special revenue fund. And they do vending machines or cafeteria work, and you'll see some of them around the Capitol complex. Another part of the special revenue fund is that the Communication Center does Braille for K-12 and also for other people who ask for Braille, and they actually sell some of the K-12 Braille to other states, and they make revenue on that, and that goes into their regular budget. There's also a gift fund in State Services for the Blind. People who want to donate for the purpose of making the printed word more available to a blind individual donate, and we get about $590,000 a year in gifts for those kinds of services. The Communication Center, which is made up of the Braille unit and the radio talking book and other oral transcription reading services, serves about 14,000 customers a year. 100 customers find work. 3,500 blind or visually impaired seniors use SSB. and they actually do about 900,000 pages of Braille. Extended employment is a program that actually provides supports to people involved in the vocational rehabilitation program so that they can continue to work. It supports them on their job site. Extended employment program is delivered by 28 community rehab providers. There's over 6,400 Minnesotans who worked 5 million hours to earn more than $30 million in wages. Without these supports, a lot of these people would not be able to work. Independent living is both a state and federal funded program. The program gets $4,760 from the general fund, not $4,760,000, and $4,830,000 from the federal government. Serves about 5,555 people, and over 5,000 Minnesotans with significant disabilities can live independently. These are served through independent living centers throughout the state. The last program highlighted here is the Disability Determination Unit. This disability determination is for people who are applying for Social Security disability. It is for the biennium, $48 million. They actually apply for disability in their home communities through the Social Security office, but the organization that actually determines whether they're eligible for Social Security disability is housed within our department. They're directly funded from the federal government, and actually we are very fortunate. We have one of the better ones in the country. We keep winning one of the top awards for the most accurate and timely determinations for people with disabilities. And that ends my division.
On page 57, I don't think this is state. I think this is federal. But on the line where it says expenditures by fund, and it says MDES federal.
57. Oh, that's MDES. That should say deed federal.
Deed federal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then. It says under governor's recommendation. It looks like it's getting cut in half. What in 11? What is that? Less federal funds coming in, or is it different use of state funds? What is that exactly?
What line are you looking at?
Where it says MDES federal
expenditure by fund.
Governor's recommendation for 11.
On page 57.
I-57 doesn't have MDES on it.
The person coming up to assist Bonnie is Cindy Farrell, our chief financial officer.
There's a reduction in Social Security. We earn, earn income on from Social Security on people that we place in employment and who maintain employment for a certain length of time. The Social Security Administration reimburses for us our cost, and there's been a reduction in the amount of money that we receive, so we don't have as much receipts to give out. We help fund the independent living centers through some of the receipts that we get through Social Security.
And we know
reimbursement.
And we know that it's going to happen in 11 already. You want to give me an answer here?
We're going to call the expert.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, this is John Sherman, who manages the Centers for Independent Living program.
Welcome, Mr. Sherman.
Actually, it's Mr. Chairman, this is John Sherman. I work, for the record, I'm in the Rehabilitation Services Unit as an analyst. And I would love to manage the program, but I'm the analyst for it. We have a joint program right now where we're using Social Security funds, which we receive sort of as a reimbursement for individuals who go off of Social Security, SSI, SSDI. And we're running, in effect, an experimental program for 3 years using a piece of those dollars where we're working jointly between our vocational rehabilitation program and the Centers for Independent Living in a collaborative effort to see if we can get better results for placing individuals into work, individuals with severe disabilities, by intentionally tying them into independent living services as well as our other employment services. We've budgeted out for 3 years. We're in about the 18th month right now, and we're beginning to examine the effectiveness. Obviously, if it becomes a very effective program, we will continue it forward, but that depends on Social Security dollars being available. These are not direct drawdown dollars from the federal vocational rehabilitation funds or the federal independent living funds. They are actually dollars that come from Social Security. And we've targeted them.
So that's a guess right now?
That's a guess. And if the I suspect that, not that I'm when making a decision, but I would imagine that if, in fact, the programs prove viable and effective in increasing our results, that we'd look strongly at continuing on past the into the second year, what would be the 11-12 biennium. Right now, however, we do not know what the future of the Social Security dollars come. It's a variable amount, typically runs between $1 and $3 million a year. And obviously, if it doesn't work, then there are other demands on those dollars from the vocational rehabilitation program. I can provide more information to the committee later if needed.
Okay. Any other questions, anybody? This had nothing to do with that. Were we trying to get some matching dollars for Centers for Independent Living last year?
Well, it's sort of a stepchild of that process at one point. For the committee's memory, we had at one point legislative authority to try and draw down direct federal vocational rehabilitation dollars, the federal 110 dollars, using independent living dollars as a match, and then sort of replacing on a dollar-for-dollar basis, splitting sort of the federal difference. We had a review by our federal, by staff from the Rehabilitation Services Administration in Washington. I'm afraid in public on testimony to use the language that they used in their description of the process. They were not happy. And so that authority disappeared last year. But in examining the after effect of that process, we realized that there really was an opportunity to take a look at doing our business a little bit differently in a way that would be get better results for our customers and would be supportive of both the centers and our vocational rehabilitation teams in the field. And we do have the Social Security dollars available to us. It's giving us a chance to explore and work through that process. But frankly, the possibility of penalties and look-back issues in terms of the original model was a risk we really didn't want to take.
So we're not sure yet if this is a wanted or unwanted stepchild, is that word?
We're not sure.
Okay.
Actually, the preliminary results are very positive. I don't want to put a negative on it. In fact, we're pretty excited by what we're seeing, but we're a year and a half in. We want to see a little bit longer what that pattern looks like.
Anything else, Commissioner?
Not on that program, Mr. Chairman. The last item on the handout is our general support services, and they're located on page 60 to 62 of your budget book. It's the dollars that fund the general administration of the agency, accounting, human resources, fiscal services, and the biggest expense, information technology. Consists of $4.8 million from the general fund, $3.983 million in direct federal funds, and $25 million in special revenue funds, which are principally indirect charges to various federal programs, including a substantial amount from unemployment insurance. That amounts to 4.6% of our overall program costs, not including unemployment insurance benefits. So we are quite we're proud of the fact that we administer the entire agency for about 4.6% of overall budget. Mr. Chairman, slide 27 is in response to a question from staff about where federal stimulus funds may come to areas under DEED's purview. This is to the best of our ability what has been in either the federal or state House or Senate bill. However, as I think you know, late on Friday night, there were a number of things cut out of the Senate bill, so we're still a little unclear as to what will happen from in the conference committee. But the top three, employment, reemployment services, voc rehab grants, and training and employment services, would go to the workforce service area. We anticipate that they would be one-time resources to be spent over 2 years. Those that come through the Workforce Investment Act would be distributed to the workforce service areas by formula. We will keep you informed, and we'll need legislative appropriation authority for any of those dollars. The two UI pieces may also require legislation. There is a very interesting provision to provide increased benefits of $25 a week to those currently on benefits and have it be federally funded. It cannot, however, simply be added to their regular payment because that would impact employer accounts. It'll have to be a separate payment, and we're working on how administratively to do that. But it's very good news for Minnesota workers who may find themselves unemployed. It's $100 a month for the length of time that they're on the regular or extended program. There's also some dollars for UI modernization that may help with some automating some portions of the process that were not automated in the new system that was completed in late 2007. We're hopeful for some EPA clean water money, which would likely, and the drinking water money would go to the Public Facilities Authority. The leaking underground storage tanks, I wish they would change how they refer to that, because everything in the federal government is known by its acronym, so that becomes the LUST account, unfortunately. but that is money that would assist our petrol fund dollars in going further and help with cleaning up contaminated sites.
Pretty good government word, though.
Yes. I recall a few years ago the League of Minnesota Cities had a four-day conference in Duluth to discuss LUST, Mr. Chairman. It was very well attended. Hazardous Substance Superfund and Brownfields account would also be a part of our community development cleanup funds. We're also hopeful of some community development block grant funds. It appears that the broadband money is going to come through two federal programs and will not, the state's not going to have anything to do with it, unfortunately. In both the federal, the House and Senate bills, the money goes 50% to the Rural Utility Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and 50% to the National Telephone Infrastructure Account in the U.S. Department of Commerce. And so there would be dollars for Minnesota citizens and utilities and co-ops, but it will be directly administered by two federal agencies and not through a state agency. That's the most we know at the moment, Mr. Chairman, but we will keep you informed as we learn more. That concludes our presentation.
Let me ask you real quickly if I got the back of the envelope numbers here. Are we looking at about $1.8 million in agency operation budget cuts and about $7.18 million in pass-through budget cuts?
Mr. Chairman, we consider Job Skills Partnership to be an agency program. And when we add up $634,000 in a reduction to business and community development, the top number in the first section, and then $442 to rehab services, $278 to services for the blind, $430 to extended employment, and $542 to general support services, that's $2.326 to kind of agency operations, $4.486 to the Job Skills Partnership, so a total of $6.8 million in direct agency programs, and about $2 million from the general fund in pure pass-throughs. Now, the Job Skills Partnership is a grants program, but it is very much administered inside the agency. It isn't passed through to anyone else.
And are there about $1.5 million in salary reductions in this?
Mr. Chairman, I need to consult with Ms. Farrell on that. I suspect it's less than that. It's 11 full-time positions, plus some reductions in things like out-of-state travel, information technology, and some other indirect or direct expenses, it is 2.326 million in reductions.
Will any of the people that will be laid off, will they be moved to the universal job seekers or be reemployed?
Mr. Chairman, under our current plan, we would be eliminating currently vacant positions, and no one currently employed by the agency would have to be laid off. However, this committee and the House acts on our budget, that could change. But we have been, because of we knew tight budgets were coming, we've been holding some open positions and putting them in places where they made the most sense. And at the moment, we would accomplish that payroll savings through eliminating currently open positions.
Okay. Any other questions, anybody? Senator Paris, don't be afraid to ask one. I won't cut you off, I promise.
You didn't.
Okay, good. All right. Thank you, everybody, and we'll be in touch. Meeting adjourned.